The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
I'm Tom Tennis, and on behalf of the Cincinnati Masonic Center, I'd like to welcome you to the Breakfast Lecture Series this morning. Before I introduce our special guest, I'd like to thank a couple people. Robert Dumford, who is the Executive Director of the Cincinnati Masonic Center, Michael Himes, the Executive Secretary, and the Cincinnati Masonic Building Engineers for setting up the room here as well as in Founders Hall. The next Breakfast Lecture Series will be on Wednesday, August 7th. And we'll feature Cincinnati City Manager Milton Dahoney Jr. As a reminder, there are comment cards on your tables. We do look at those. And any comments you'd like to make, please do so. Hopefully make suggestions on future speakers. Following, there will be an optional tour of the building, the Cincinnati Masonic Center. If you've not done that, you really should do that. It's an amazing building. This morning's Breakfast Lecture Series featured speaker is Hamilton County Sheriff Jim Neal. Sheriff Neal is a lifelong resident of Hamilton County. He's a graduate of Western Hills High School. He earned a Bachelor of Science degree in criminal justice and a master's degree in graduate studies and research at the University of Cincinnati. He has completed more than 4,000 hours in his over 30 years with the Hamilton County Sheriff's Department. Please join me in welcoming Sheriff Jim Neal.
Thank you. Anyhow, as you can see from the information up on this screen, I'm more comfortable in my skin as a peace officer rather than an elected official. And that's how I'm leading this organization. You know, a leader's job is to do things right. And I'm more comfortable as a peace officer in running this organization. As mentioned, I was raised in Western Hamilton County, Price Hill, Fairmount, west side of town, graduated from Western Hills. But I'm also second-generation law enforcement. And you're going to find in public service, especially on the west side, if your father was a police officer, a firefighter, or a school teacher, the likelihood is that you're going to follow one of your parents' footsteps into that profession. And there is tradition. My father, Jim Neal, he retired from the city of Cincinnati and served primarily the bulk of his career in what we call Cincinnati District 5, and his beat area was Camp Washington, and consequently, that's where I got my start in the sheriff's office, Camp Washington, at the old workhouse before they tore it down. Neat building. Awesome place. A lot of history there. But why go into law enforcement? That was the question asked of me throughout the whole campaign trail. I do my best work serving others rather than being self-serving. Simon Lease was sheriff for 25 years. I worked for Sheriff Lease for 24 of those years. I was a lieutenant commander when I retired. I commanded the bomb squad. I was one of the patrol academy commanders, and also I oversaw the outside employment of the deputy sheriffs hired by the private sector to do security and or traffic functions. But this race, I was outspent 15-1. I raised $42,000. My opponent raised almost $700,000. Grassroots campaigning still works, ladies and gentlemen. It still works. People want to see their candidates. They want to ask you in person those hard questions, like, why should I vote for you? Why are you involved in law enforcement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I had a lot of support, and I have witness here. Sergeant Randy can tell you that I had the endorsement of the FOP, Lodge 69, as well as the firefighters, 48, and a number of the private sector unions. I am truly the labor's candidate in this past election with the endorsements that I received. Never had an opportunity for a transition. I won the election November, took over January the 7th. That's where the transition started, January the 7th. We started off boots on the ground and running. We went from 8 majors down to 3. As a leader, my motto, and this is something I adopted from the Hamilton County Police Association, is called cooperation and operation. Working together with the other police agencies in Hamilton County to bring the best services that we can to the people of Hamilton County. The crash that occurred on 275 in Coleraine Township. 91 units in that crash. 90 of them were motor vehicles. One unit was a pedestrian. She was killed as a result of this collision. But what you don't know, there were 25 officers out there on that highway asking for driver's license and insurance cards. 25 officers to handle this crash. Not to count the officers that were blocking the on-ramps to this interstate, but actually at the crash scene in and of itself, collecting driver's license and insurance cards, putting together the investigation. Of those 25, 16 were sheriff's deputies. We had 2 from Coleraine Township, a couple officers from Springfield Township, a couple from Forest Park. One even came up from Mount Healthy. Cooperation and operation, working together. The significance of that is there's only one law enforcement agency in Hamilton County that can handle a major incident. And that agency is Cincinnati Police Division. Cincinnati is the only police agency with enough police personnel to handle a major incident. So when you get out into the villages and the smaller cities in Hamilton County and out into the unincorporated areas, we are able to do so through cooperation and operation. That's why I'm an advocate to maintain a strong enforcement division for the sheriff's office, because life does happen. This crash was the largest in state's history and one of the largest in our country's history. And if you take those 16 sheriff's deputies out of the picture, now you have 9 officers out there handling a crash that took 25 officers 7 hours to clear the highway. That's phenomenal. 91 cars, and we cleared the highway in 7 hours. Cooperation and operation. And it goes beyond police. There was 12 fire companies out there, 12 fire companies from different agencies. There was also Metro Bus sent a bus out there to provide transportation of those whose vehicles were disabled off the highway, provide transportation to get the victims off the highways. And then also, all of the people in the private sector are wrecker drivers that came out to remove these cars. 7 hours. I mean, think about it. This never happened before, but we handled it. The picture I'm trying to paint here is that life does happen. Major incidents do happen, you know, just like recently in Boston, Massachusetts. But I'm telling you, we here in Hamilton County, in law enforcement, cooperation, operation, we work together, we train together. And we're also coming up this month, there's going to be a mock disaster training incident where a number of our agencies are going to be involved. We do this all the time so that when life happens, we're prepared. You got to understand, there's 49 communities in Hamilton County. These communities are villages, they're cities, and they're townships. 49 of them that provide services to their people. Of these 49 communities, we are, when I say we are, the sheriff's office is the primary enforcement agency for a number of these communities. But we're also the communities, the villages and cities that have their own agencies, we still have what we call concurrent jurisdiction, which means we still, as deputy sheriffs, have police powers in Hamilton County as well as in all the villages and cities within Hamilton County. So, again, that's why cooperation and operation works. Now, to take that further, we joined up recently with the U.S. Marshals. The U.S. Marshals have a unit designed to investigate and apprehend fugitives. You know what? The sheriff's office has a unit that does the same thing. Wait a minute. We have unit here. We're after the same people. Let's join forces. Let's have one big team sharing resources, including human resources, to go after the same offenders, the same fugitives. It just makes sense, especially in these economic times. Ridding of duplication of service, joining forces, cooperation and operation, going after the same fugitives. The plus of this is now these sheriff's deputies, not only do these deputies have jurisdiction in Hamilton County, they've been deputized as marshals. They have jurisdiction in northern Kentucky. They have jurisdiction in Indiana. So these officers, these deputies, and these U.S. marshals can go anywhere in our region to arrest these fugitives. So it's a win-win. As I mentioned, we have 49 communities. My goal is, through the Hamilton County Police Association, which we are a member of, but now we're active with. I'm the first deputy sheriff, and I'm a sheriff, but I'm the first deputy sheriff in over close to 20 years that has been embedded in a Hamilton County Police Association operation. This week, Chief Lindsay from Harrison, Ohio, honored me and inducted me into the Hamilton County SWAT team as the EOD commander. EOD is Explosive Ordnance Disposal because of my background. But I'm now a honorary member of the SWAT team. But more importantly, we have a number of candidates that are going through the process now to be embedded in the Hamilton County SWAT team. And it's just not the SWAT team. It's all of our specialized services. The sheriff's office now is no longer an island unto ourselves. We're working with other agencies throughout not only our county but the region, providing shared services for special needs areas like SWAT, dive team, Marine Patrol, Honor Guard. Where we're not regional already, we're joining in through the Hamilton County Police Association, ACPA, and bring in regional services such as the Honor Guard and the SWAT team. We're already regional on Bomb Squad. We work well with Cincinnati Fire and Butler County Sheriff. We're already regional with our dive team. We work with Sheriff Sims from Warren County, Sheriff Jones from Butler County, and Sheriff Rodenberg from Claremont County, and Sheriff Neal from Hamilton County. We make up, and the Sims Township Fire Department and Loveland Fire Department, those agencies all make up the dive team. And as you can see, that's a truly regional team involving multiple counties. Our bomb squad covers 15 counties in Southwest, Southeast, Ohio, Northern Kentucky, and we make ourselves available also for Dearborn County because of their gaming facilities that they have there for our ability to get there quickly until the bomb squad from Indianapolis can make it there. Cooperation and operation, you're going to hear me repeat it. This is where I'm coming from. Again, I'm going to reiterate, I'm running this agency, this organization, as a law enforcement professional rather than as an elected official. But the neat thing is, I am an elected official. Each and every one of you registered voters put me into office, and I'm here to serve you. And I'm looking out for your best interest, not my best interest, your best interest. I already mentioned we went from 8 majors down to 3 majors. The money I saved, I reinvested into hiring a recruit class for the jail academy. Their graduation is tomorrow night. So it was a wash. The money I saved purchased more boots on the ground, more service providers, more line officers, and less administrators. We're doing more with less because we're consolidating as well. We've gone from a multitude of divisions down to three divisions. We have an enforcement division, which includes investigation. We also have courts. We're merged in with the jail, so we have the court and jail division. And we also have a newly created division, which is support service division, which is support service is made up of just that, support service, our logistics, but also our planning section, which is newly formed. We've never had a planning section, believe it or not. We do now. And also a training section makes up our support services. Also, on the campaign, I mentioned an audit, an independent, unbiased performance audit. Now, performance audit is just that. They're looking at us as an organization to make sure we're as efficient and effective as we can be. I hired retired Chief Tom Stryker and Scott Greenwood, LLC, to conduct that audit. They're both local professionals, top of their game, respective as a police commander and as an attorney, and they're going to bring a wealth of information to me and my office so that I can share with you, the people that we're serving, where we're strong, where we're deficient, where we need to go. And I can also inform the commissioners likewise and the county administrator of the results of this audit so that we can plan to meet the needs. You know, we are a service provider. That's our product, a service. And again, I'm going to reiterate that, is that the service that we provide is what's important to me. And I want to make sure that you all are getting the best service, even in these economic times, because we went from 1,000 employees down to 800 through the cuts. Another campaign promise was to stop the revolving door. As a law enforcement officer, it's embarrassing. It's unacceptable for me to make a physical arrest. And folks, you go through great lengths in making a lot of arrests because people naturally avoid apprehension. They will resist you to avoid apprehension. So officers many times are hurt in this process. Where I'm going with this, I'm sitting down in intake, filling out the paperwork. I brought an arrestee in. I'm filling out the paperwork. Next thing you know, wait, where's that guy going? He's beating me back to territory. I'm still stuck down here in the jail filling out paperwork, and he's already out there walking on the street. He was processed in, given a court date, and set free. Now, what's happening here is they're not showing up for court in the morning, which the judges' dockets are thinned out because they're failing to show for court. So capiuses are being issued, and it costs money to clear them capiuses as well. But more importantly, it's an insult to you, the victims of the crime. It's an insult to the officer that these arrested individuals are released. What we're doing now is holding them until either A, they make bail or bond, or B, they see the judge in the morning to face justice. Now, if the judge decides to OR them, release on your own recognizance, that's fine. We did our job. We arrested them. We held them for court. They went to court. So the revolving door has stopped. Now, to introduce you, because this is such a big operation, to introduce this revolving door process-only information is Major Charmaine McGuffey.
So we sat down under Sheriff Neil's direction, under his counsel, and we did devise a way to close that revolving door. And it's no small deal because for several years, as I mentioned and as the sheriff mentioned, they'd been doing that process only. And people typically will now ask us, well, how can you come in after 3 months and close that revolving door that has been in process for several years? And this is the way we did it. The first thing we did is we looked at our general population. And we have a consent decree. Now, the consent decree says that we can only put 1,240 inmates in our jail. All right? So we have to count those inmates each night and make sure that we don't go over that amount of 1,240 inmates. So what was happening was, in our count, we're including detention females, and these are the females that are brought in overnight, that are arrested during the day, and detention males. These are people that are brought in, obviously arrested, and so forth. Now, our general population, as I noted, 1,240. Well, when you count all these people, and this is another example, when they were doing the body count with all the detention prisoners and the actual inmates, we were coming up with 1,268 inmates. Well, that's way over our cap. So the old administration was saying, well, let's let them out the door. What we said was, wait a minute, let's take a good look at who we're counting and who those people really are and how they're actually classified. When we do create the count, and we count actually only the inmates, and you can see that in red, I highlighted that in red, only the inmates, we actually came up with 1,228. So, you know what? We're within the cap. So how we differentiate between a detention prisoner, which should be done, and an inmate is this. An inmate is defined as they go through arraignment court, they're interviewed and reviewed, they're dressed out in our jail uniform, et cetera. They have a medical evaluation, and that includes making appointments for them, setting up clinic runs and so forth. Some of the inmates, and many of them, come in, they have drug and alcohol problems, so we have to detox them and so forth. They're classified, they're assigned a permanent housing location, and that's by level, minimum, medium, maximum. A detention prisoner is defined as someone who comes in, they're booked, fingerprinted, they get to see a public defender, and they're waiting for arraignment court. That's it. That's a detention prisoner. That's a very different animal than, if I can say it that way, than someone who is classified as an inmate. And we looked at that consent decree and we said, well, wait a minute. Then we can differentiate in the count, and we can hold these detention prisoners and count them as separate so they don't come onto our consent decree count. Our capacity, by the way, is 1,430 inmates. So we are able to hold these inmates since we're not counting them in our consent decree count. Now, as you can see, we have to classify everybody as either max, medium, or minimum. We can't put a minimum in with a max. We have to do medium max, all right? So we have to be very careful about who gets housed with who. And our jail is limited in its particular spacing. And by that I mean, if you'll see how I have the single juvenile cells here, there's eight of them in that pod, in H pod. This is representative of our actual layout of the jail. Now, we have eight cells in there that are designated for juveniles that are bound over as adults. Well, what happens if we get nine juveniles? Because juveniles are not allowed to have any interaction with adults in any way, shape, or form, adult prisoners. So if we get nine juveniles, well, you know what? We're going to have to move them over to A-Pod and move those max people over here to probably C-Pod, move some of the minimum people that we have in C-Pod over to D-Pod, and then try to level it out that way. So you can see that it is a constant battle to keep everybody moving and everybody classified exactly where they need to be. And this was one of the things that was problematic for us when we were keeping detention prisoners. And we said, well, you know what? We can take a detention prisoner and we can embed them in any one of these units. Why? Because a detention prisoner is in their civilian clothes and they are locked in that cell individually. They have no interaction with other inmates. We feed them in the cell. We bring them out for court with an escorted officer, etc. So we did find space to keep those detention prisoners since we discovered we can count them in a different way. Now, something that's problematic with our structure in the jail, many prisoners that come in the jail either have mental health issues or drug issues or alcohol issues or sometimes all of those issues. And we have to house them in a very specific place in a very specific way. Our medical unit is staffed by 24-hour nursing staff. Our psych unit, our mental health unit, is 24-hour mental health staff. We have to provide those services for these people that are coming in and detoxing, which is a very dangerous situation for anyone who's been an alcoholic for years and years, particularly heroin addicts. We're seeing a whole lot more of them. And this is our limitation in bed space, 43 beds. That 8 represents the female bed space that we have, 38 beds in mental health, and the 8 represents an overflow for medical. So you can see that throughout the jail, when you look at, okay, we can hold 1,240 prisoners, and we're pretty close to that, most of those prisoners have medical issues and mental health problems, but we only have this much space designated for them. We're locked into that because we have to have on-site nursing staff. We have to have medical staff on site to manage these people. What we've done, because we said, well, you know what, in holding these process-only people that we used to process out, now we've got to figure out a way to empty out medical. We got to figure out a way to get somebody who comes to medical, and believe me, we have prisoners come down there. We had one guy, he came in a wheelchair. He had a tube running through him. He had multiple problems medically, had to be taken to the clinic every day. We have guys that come down, they're on dialysis. We have to transport them up for dialysis each and every day. And we said, you know what, let's do something different with those prisoners, and let's utilize some of our other options. And one of the things that we did is, first of all, in holding those prisoners, we increased inmate movement, data processing, the dockets got longer, we feed them more food, and we obviously have more medical housing. So I just explained to you why that happens. And then what I'd like to show you is our population is going to rise by approximately 20% in the summer. We know that. I mean, that's just the way it is. And plus now we have the casino. So given those items, what we say is this. We say, how can we manage our population, keep that door shut with our medical constraint, our population rising, and the fact that it creates longer and more movement and more work inside the jail? And to that, we say, we know we have these issues, classification, records, data entry, security, and we've started working on the back end of corrections. And by that, I mean this. When I come in, I'm arrested for whatever it is I'm arrested for, I need to stay in jail. I need to see a judge. I need to get referred to wherever I'm going to go, possibly another agency. And there's a lot of agencies out there, and we need to start using them, and we need to start educating the judges as to what those agencies are. For instance, we have an arrest. We do our intake process. The prisoner waits for arraignment. Now, that prisoner stays in jail until the judge sees them and can refer them to any one of these types of agencies. A reentry program, electronic monitoring, Talbert House services, mental health services, and we can move that inmate out of our jail to those service agencies. I want to highlight electronic monitoring for you for a moment, because one of the things that Sheriff Neal and I talked about extensively, and one of the things that he told me to do, is look at electronic monitoring. Find out how we can get these people on home incarceration. Why are they not on home incarceration, some of these people that we call low-level offenders? Well, we took a look at it, and we started to say, you know what, this is what we have with electronic monitoring, and we're going to start using it more. And I'll tell you what these things do very quickly. This particular unit here, that is our old RF unit, and what that does is you put the ankle bracelet on, you plug the RF unit into a phone line, and it tells us when you leave and go. When you go out the door, when you come back. That's what we get on the computer. Now, that gets hooked into a home phone line. How many people have a home phone line anymore? Not very many of us. So that's quickly outdated. And the next unit we have here is the one that looks like a phone. The prisoner carries that phone around, can get audible messages from the officer. They plug in the base unit there, and they wear that ankle bracelet. And with that phone, we can actually do GPS tracking. We can track that person wherever they go. This unit here off to the left is our newest unit. That little thing is a wonderful little unit. Technology obviously is speeding along, and we're reaping the benefits of that. That small unit goes on your ankle. It does not require the base unit to be plugged into a phone line. You get a little battery-operated gizmo like this. You set it on your dresser. You have that on your ankle. And we literally can pull up on the computer and see where you went each and every day, all the time. We can track that in real time. We can tell whether or not you were in a car when you were traveling, whether you were walking, where you stopped, how long you stayed where you stopped, and so forth. That device also gives us the technology to send the offender a message. In that device, we have embedded a message component where the officer can type in a message and we can say whatever it is we want to say to that offender, right? Stop doing crime, go home, call your officer, and it beeps, and we have to then know that the prisoner got the message, and what they do is they put their thumb on a particular part of that unit, and it stops the message, so we know they got it. If they don't put their thumb on that particular part of the unit, that message keeps playing over and over again, and it's quite loud. So it's an excellent piece of technology that we're now using. And I'm going to remind you back to our medical structure issue. Why can't we put a guy that's on dialysis on that box? Where's he going? He has to go to the hospital every day and get on that machine. We put him on that box. He goes home. He does his own transportation, pays his own medical costs, does all of the things that we need him to do because we know where he's at. And that's one of the things we're going to utilize in keeping this revolving door shut. We're going to ramp up our electronic monitoring unit. The sheriff has given us the go-ahead to do that. And that's what we're working on to keep that revolving door shut. Now, one of the things I want to exemplify for you here is daily cost of incarceration, $65 a day, it costs all of us to keep an inmate in jail. $9.50 a day for an inmate to be on electronic monitoring. That's because they're using their own electricity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Our capabilities with this can be phenomenal. Here's a guy that we track to the trunk of a car. You can't see it because of the light, but he's wearing our ankle bracelet right there. He climbed in the trunk of the car to try and elude our officers who were tracking him on our GPS devices. And when we opened that, we kept going around that trunk and, you know, he's pinging on this car. So we opened the trunk of the car and there he is. And you see that little dot on his wrist? That's Brian Hale, one of our officers. That's his taser dot. So he put the taser dot on that guy and told him to stay put and had me run and get the camera. That's how good this technology is, and this is exactly why we have a lot of faith in using it, along with our other agencies, and start referring people to those agencies that want to get in touch with them, that want to help manage them. We have a critical mass now. We're looking to get 215 more units that do not require a phone line. We are right now, since we started advertising this to the public and educating the judges and so on and so forth on it and letting them know what our intentions are, we have maxed out. We're all out of those newer units. We have some 200 of them now, and they are all in use, and we have a demand for more. So the sheriff is working on finding us some funding to increase that program.
We're not going to have metro policing in Hamilton County in the near future. Too many politicians, too many governments, too many communities. Each community has mayors, they have city council, they have trustees. It ain't going to happen. It's not because of us, it's because of the elected officials. They don't want to give up that power. But we, as officers from various agencies, can take it upon ourselves to come together and work together. That's where our metro is going to be in the future.